Chapter 3. Soviet Russia. The religion of Marxism is the falsification of knowledge. Whence comes this fierce hatred of intellectuals for the least barbaric societies of human history, and this rage to destroy the only civilizations to date that have emphatically conferred a dominant rule on intelligence? Jean Francis Revel, The Flight from Truth. The Reign of Deceit in the Age of Information. Soviet Russia was allowed to emerge from the destruction of World War II as one of the victors, solely because she was needed as the next evil empire against which the civilized West could launch a new crusade. Because Russia was bankrupt, had lost 40 million of her population in the war, plus another 66 million murdered by the Bolsheviki since 1917, and was unable to feed herself, once again the world order was obliged to step in with enormous subsidies of food and material from the US, in order to maintain an enemy power. The Belgian Relief Commission of 1916 became the Marshall Plan of 1948. Once again, the loads of supplies were shipped into Europe, ostensibly for our allies, but destined to maintain the Soviet bloc. Although Jacob Schiff's personal agent, George Kennan, had regularly toured Russia during the latter part of the 19th century, bringing in money and arms for the communist revolutionaries, his grandson said that Schiff had spent $20 million to bring about the Bolshevik Revolution. More concerted aid was called for to support an entire regime. Kennan also aided Schiff in financing the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. The Japanese decorated Kennan with the Gold War Medal and the Order of the Sacred Treasure. In 1915, the American International Corporation was formed in New York. Its principal goal was the coordination of aid, particularly financial assistance, to the Bolsheviks, which had previously been provided by Schiff and other bankers on an informal basis. The new firm was funded by J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, and the National City Bank. Chairman of the board was Frank Van Verlick, former president of National City, and member of the Jekyll Island Group, which wrote the Federal Reserve Act in 1910. Directors were Pierre DuPont, Otto Kahn of Kuhn, Leib Company, George Herbert Walker, grandfather of President George H. Bush, William Woodward, director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Robert S. Lovett, right-hand man of the Harriman Kuhn, Leib Union Pacific Railroad, Percy Rockefeller, John D. Ryan, J. A. Stillman, son of James Stillman, principal organizer of the National City Bank, A. H. Wiggin, and Beekman Winthrop. The 1928 list of eight directors included Percy Rockefeller, Pierre DuPont, Elisha Walker of Kuhn, Leib Company, and Frank Altskill of Lazard Freers. In their program of aiding the communists, Ake worked closely with Guarantee Trust of New York, now Morgan Guarantee Trust. Guarantee Trust's directors in 1903 included George F. Baker, founder of the First National Bank, August Belmont, representative of the Rothschilds, E. H. Harriman, founder of Union Pacific Railroad, former vice president of the U.S., Levi Morton, who was a director of U.S. Steel and the Union Pacific, Henry H. Rogers, partner of John D. Rockefeller in Standard Oil, also a director of Union Pacific, H.M.C. K. Twombly, who married the daughter of William Vanderbilt, and was now the director of 50 banks and industries, Frederick W. Vanderbilt, and Harry Payne Whitney. No one would seriously believe that bankers of this magnitude would finance an anti-capitalist revolution for the communists, yet this is exactly what happened. These same men financed Woodrow Wilson's political campaigns, and it was these same men to whom Wilson referred in his opening address to the Paris Peace Conference, when he said, "There is moreover a voice calling for these definitions of principles and purposes which is, it seems to me, more thrilling and more compelling than any of the moving voices with which the troubled air of the world is filled. It is the voice of the Russian people. There are men in the United States of the finest temper who are in sympathy with Bolshevism, because it appears to them to offer that 64, 65 regime of opportunity to the individual which they desire to bring about. The great conspiracy against Russia, Seghers and Kahn. The men of the finest temper, to whom Wilson referred, the Morgans and the Rockefellers, did not really desire opportunity for the underscore individual. What they desired was the lifelong imposition of slavery under the world order, and this is the goal which they continue to strive to achieve, on a world-wide basis. These Americans of the finest temper chose Lenin to do their work, because he had outlined the plan they wanted in the threatening catastrophe in September, 1917. 1. Nationalization of the banks. Ownership of capital which is manipulated by the banks is not lost or changed when the banks are nationalized and fused into one state bank, so that it is possible to reach a stage where the state knows whither and how, from where and at what time millions and billions are flowing. Only control over bank operations providing they are merged into one state bank will allow, simultaneously with other measures which can easily be put into effect, the actual levying of income tax cap vitout concealment of property and income. The state for the first time would be in a position to survey all the monetary operations, then to control them, then to regulate economic life. Finally, to obtain millions and billions for large state operations, without paying the capitalist gentlemen sky-high commissions for their services. It would facilitate the nationalization of syndicates, abolition of commercial secrets, denationalization of the insurance business, facilitate the control of and the compulsory organization of labor into unions, and the regulation of consumption. The nationalization of banks would make circulation of checks compulsory by law for all the rich, and introduce the confiscation of property for concealing incomes. The 5 points of the desired program then tear: nationalization of the banks, nationalization of the syndicates, the abolition of commercial secrets, and the compulsory organization of the population into consumer associations, right square bracket. It was the publication of this program which catapulted Lenin into the leadership of Russia via the Bolshevik Revolution. In 1917, Frank. 66. Van Berlet publicly referred to Lenin as the modern version of George Washington. The Lenin program is not only the program of Soviet Russia, it is the program of Roosevelt's New Deal, Truman's socialism, the post-war labor government in England, and the guiding principle of subsequent American administrations. The labor government of England proved Lenin's dictum that the ownership of capital is not affected by the nationalization of the banks, when they nationalized the Bank of England. The Lenin program is the entire program of the U.S. Internal Revenue Service, the actual levying of income tax without concealment of property or income, the confiscation property for concealing incomes. The Lenin program is the program of the big rich precisely, because it abstract and puts it under the control of the state. The state is controlled by the big rich, the world order. The definitive authority of the Lenin program captured the attention of the financiers. Here was the opportunity to subdue and control all future competition with the power of a totalitarian state, to stifle future development, and to hold the entire population of the world in thrall to their greed. This program took Lenin back to Moscow to seize the government by force and to rule by terrorism. In Germany and the Russian Revolution, we find telegram number 952D2615 ST8AC, to Min in Copenhagen, your embassy is authorized to pay 1 million rubles to Helfand. The corresponding sum should be drawn from the legation assets. Minister Copenhagen, the 23rd of January 1916, Dr. Helfand, the sum of 1 million rubles already reached Pefigrad, and devoted to the purposes for which it was intended. On May 8th, Berlin requested 130,000 M for Russian propaganda. Uitter Secretary State to the Minister in Bern, telegram number 348, it was considered advantageous to Germany to bring out the members of Lenin's party, the Bolsheviks, who are about 40 in number. The special train VI-11B under military escort. 57. Vernadsky says, in his Life of Lenin, in the autumn of 1915, the German-Russian Social Democrat Parvus Helfand, Israel Lazarevich, who had formerly been active in the revolution of 1905, announced the paper published by him in Berlin, The Bell, his mission to serve as an intellectual link between the armed Germans and the revolutionary Russian proletariat. During the war, Helfand was engaged in furnishing supplies to the Germany army in huge quantities, and so considerable amounts of money passed through his hands. A railway car in which were Lenin, Martov, and other exiles was attached to the train leaving for Germany from Switzerland on April 8, 1917. On April 13, Lenin embarked on the steamer sailing from Sassnitz to Sweden. So the trip through Germany took at least 4 days. The Leninists quickly exhausted the funds advanced by the Germans when they reached Russia, and once again the Bolshevik bid for absolute power seemed in doubt. To whom should Lenin turn but his powerful friend in the White House? Wilson promptly sent Elihu Root, Kunalka's lawyer and former Secretary of State, to Russia with $20 million from his special war fund, to be given to the Bolsheviks. This was revealed in congressional hearings on Russian bonds H.J. 8714.U5, which shows the financial statement of Woodrow Wilson's expenditure of the $100 million voted him by Congress, as a special war fund. The statement, showing the expenditure of $20 million in Russia by Root's special war mission to Russia, is also recorded in the congressional record, September 2, as given by Wilson's secretary, Joseph Tumulty. Not to be outdone in generosity, J.P. Morgan and Company also rushed financial assistance to the beleaguered Lenin Terroris T.S. Colonel Raymond Robbins headed a Red Cross mission to Russia. H. Henry P. Deviso and J.P. Morgan's right-hand man, also a member of the Jekyll Island team which secretly wrote the Federal Reserve Act in 191-0, had raised $370 million in cash for the Red Cross during World War I, of which several millions were brought to the Russians by Robbins' team. Aiding him in this charitable work were Frank Van Verlick, chairman of American International Corporation, and William Boyce Thompson, another. 68. Director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Major Harold H. Swift, head of the meatpacking family, accompanied Robbins on this mission of mercy, or should we say business? Swift used the occasion to garner a $LT million meat order for his brother-in-law, Edward Morris, of Morris Company. On January 22, the Soviets ordered another $50 million of meat from Morris Company. Wall Street lawyer Thomas D. Thatcher was also a key man of the Robbins mission of mercy. The involvement of the J.P. Morgan firm with the Bolshevik Revolution is revealed in Harold Nicholson's biography of Dwight Morrow. Morrow was the father-in-law of Charles Lindbergh Jr., as follows: his, Morrow's, interest in Russia dated from March 1917 when Thomas D. Thatcher, his law partner, had been a member of the American Red Cross mission during the Revolution. It was strengthened by his friendship with Alex Gumberg, who had come to New York as representative of the All-Russian Textile Syndicate. "I have felt," he wrote in May 1927, "that the time would come when something would have to be done for Russia." He was himself active in furthering official relations between Soviet emissaries and the State Department, and he provided M. Litvinov with a warm letter of recommendation to Sir Arthur Salter in Geneva. Nor was this all. When in Paris he gave a dinner party at Foyt's to which he invited M. Rakovsky and other Soviet representatives. Morrow's actions might be understandable in a professor of economics at Polytechnic U, but they are incredible from a partner of the world's most prominent banking firm. Alex Gumberg was no mewling social worker but a hardcore propagandist, who returned to the U.S. in 1918 as Trotsky's literary agent, and promptly placed two Trotsky manuscripts with publishers. Gumberg also became consultant to Chase National Bank, and Simpson Thatcher and Bartlett. He had been business manager of the Soviet paper Novy Mir during the first months of revolution in Russia. When Raymond Robbins' Red Cross mission arrived in Russia, Gumberg served as interpreter and advisor to the mission, working closely with Thatcher. The present senior partner of Simpson Thatcher and Bartlett is Cyrus Vance, who served. 69. As Carter's Secretary of State, and is now a director of the Rockefeller Foundation. The international financiers, advised by Gumberg, now launched a worldwide propaganda campaign to sell the Bolsheviks as idealists, selfless humanitarians, and the modern disciples of Christ, who wished only to spread brotherhood and universal love throughout the world. The tune rang strangely against the backdrop of the machine guns steadily chattering in Russia, as the disciples of love massacred millions of women and children, but none of their devout admirers in the United States heard this as a sour note. From the outset, the humanitarians showed an excessive concern for the material wealth which they had seized from its rightful owners. The New York Times noted on January 30, a dispatch from Petrograd, "The people's commissaries have decreed a state monopoly of gold. Churches, museums and other public institutions are required to place their gold articles at the disposal of the state. Gold articles belonging to private persons must be handed over to the state. Informants will receive 1/3 of the value of the articles." Lenin said, "The Soviet Union must carefully save its gold. When living with the wolves, howl like the wolves. One of the first orders issued by the new regime was, the banking business is declared a state monopoly. Signed, Lenin, Krylenko, Podvolsky, Gorbunov. Marx's philosophy of history claims that the world operates solely through the economic organization of society, based on the production and exchange of goods. However, this is the worldview of the parasite, who is concerned only with obtaining his sustenance from the host. The materialist reduction of life to the obtaining of food at someone else's expense eliminates first, man's spiritual life, second, all ideas, because the materialist idea explicitly excludes all other ideas, and third, the low in G-term view, the concept PT of investing over a period of time for a return which will not be available for years or 70. Perhaps never. The parasitic view is limited to the next meal, or to creating a situation in which he cannot be dislodged before obtaining his next meal. This Marxist short-term view H, as become E-T-H-E-Capt-A-N-D-A-R-D doctrine in American graduate schools of business, particularly Harvard, which was financed by George F. Baker and J.P. Morgan. The result is that American industry, limited by the short-term view, has steadily declined for 25 years. The high interest rates imposed by the international bankers also force industry to concentrate on short-term gains merely to pay interest on their loans. Marx said, the first function of gold is to give the commercial world a material by which to express value, that is, to express the value of all other goods, as hominous variables, that are qualitatively identical and quantitatively comparable. Karl Marx Sock V. 23, p. 104. Marx's economic views were entirely compatible with the views of the banking establishment in the City of London and particularly the House of Rothschild. It is no accident that Karl Marx is buried, not in Moscow, but in London on, nor is it an accident that the triumph and bloodbath of the Bolsheviks in Russia gave the Rothschilds and their associates $1 billion in cash which the luckless Tsar had deposited in their European and New York banks. Few people know that Marx H. had close relations with the British aristocracy through his marriage to Jenny von Westphalen. She was related to the Scottish Duchess of Argyll, who had long been revolutionaries, and the Campbells, who set up the Baptist splinter group, the Campbellites. Jenny von Westphalen's ancestor, Anna Campbell, Countess of Balcarres and Argyll, was governess to the Prince of Orange from 1657 to 59, the future King William who later granted the charter of the Bank of England, Archibald Campbell, 1st Duke of Argyll, accompanied William on his voyage to England in 1688 to seize the throne. The present Earl of Balcarres is related to Viscount Cowdray, Wheatman John Churchill Pearson, whose mother was the daughter of Lord Spencer Churchill, his sister married the Duke of Atholl, and he married the daughter of the Earl of Bradford. The Argyll Balcarres family is represented by the Lindsay and Campbell families, the 71. Present Earl of Crawford, Robert A. Lindsay is the 29th Earl, and also the 12nd Earl of Balcarres. He is also chairman of National Westminster Bank, director of Rothschild's Sun Alliance Assurance. His mother was a Cavendish. He was formerly private secretary to the Secretary of State, and later served as Minister of State for Defense and Minister of State for Foreign and Commercial Affairs. Despite a later reputation for anti-communism, Herbert Hoover was not only the most tireless proponent of the League of Nations in partnership with Colonel House, he also was the first American to step in with large-scale assistance to prevent a massive uprising against the faltering Bolshevik regime. Hoover saved the Bolsheviks by organizing a massive program to rush food to the beleaguered communists. Hoover enlisted one of his old colleagues from the World War Relief Agency, Major General William N. Haskell, who had been head of American relief mission to Romania, and later directed all relief in the Caucasus and Russia. On September 23, 1921, Haskell embarked on his new mission of mercy, to feed the Bolsheviks, so that they would have the strength to continue their mass murders of the landowners and businessmen. Haskell continued this relief work until 1923, when it was determined that the Bolshevik regime was no longer in danger. For this effort, Herbert Hoover won massive opposition in his later political career as an anti-communist. Things indeed are not always what they seem under the rule of the world order. The Hoover effort had provided 700 tons of food and other supplies at a cost of $78 million. $20 million was appropriated by Congress for the program. $40 million came from public charities. $8 million worth of medical supplies was donated by the U.S. Army, and the Russians themselves paid $8 million from their gold supplies. Fr. On the late Caesar. After General Haskell's departure, Stalin arrested anyone who had worked with them on this program. He could not afford to allow anyone to mention the help that his regime had received from a capitalist country. On November 28, his associate, Colonel Househead Cabled Wilson, a few days after the Bolsheviks seized power, urging the extreme importance of suppressing all American newspaper criticism of the Bolsheviks, "It is exceedingly important. 72. That such criticism be suppressed." The telegram was placed in a confidential file, and only came to light 6 years later. In the unknown war with Russia, Robert J. Maddox noted in 1977, Wilson repeated the March Revolution in Russia as an amateur step toward achieving the kind of post-war world he envisioned. He made sure the U.S. was the first to recognize the provisional government. Maddox points out that Wilson insisted that number 6 of his famous 14 points at Versailles was that Russia should continue under institutions of her own choosing, thus guaranteeing the future of the Bolshevik regime. His closest political aide, Colonel House, sent his own secretary, Kenneth Brandt, to Russia to become a secretary in the Soviet Bureau in 1920. William Lawrence Sanders, chairman of Ingersoll Rand and deputy chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, wrote to Wilson, October 17, 1918, "I am in sympathy with the Soviet form of government, as the best suited for the Russian people." George Foster Peabody, also deputy chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, since 1914, and noted philanthropist who organized the General Education Board for the Rockefellers, stated that he supported the Bolshevik form of state monopoly. Thus we had three of the most prominent officials of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York underscore on record as supporting Bolshevism: Sanders, Peabody, and William Boyce Thompson. Thompson then announced he was giving $1 million to promote Bolshevik propaganda in the United States. Because the Federal Reserve Bank of New York was controlled by five New York banks who owned 53% of its stock, and because these five banks were directly controlled by N.M. Cap Rothschild's Sons of London, we can only conclude that these three men were merely stating the preferences of their employer. William Boyce Thompson led one of the strangest migrations in history, when 15 prominent Wall Street attorneys and financiers journeyed to Russia to save the tottering Bolshevik regime. J.P. Morgan cabled Thompson $1 million for this mission from the National City Bank branch in Petrograd, which, significantly, was the only bank never molested by the Bolshevik government. The Washington Post, February 2, 1918. 73. Stated, William Boyce Thompson, who was in Petrograd until November, has made a personal contribution of $1 million to the Bolsheviks for the purpose of spreading their doctrine in Germany and Austria. The Thompson mission included Henry P. Davison, head of the American Red Cross, and one of the Jekyll Island conspirators in 1910 who secretly drafted the Federal Reserve Act, Thomas Thatcher, and Harold Swift, all of whom were founders of the Council on Foreign Relations. The National City Bank had already loaned Russia $50 million, and Guaranty Trust, whose directors were the leading financiers in New York, now became the financial correspondent for Soviet interests in America. In January 1922, Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover introduced on behalf of Guaranty Trust a resolution permitting relations with the new state bank at Moscow. Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes strongly opposed this resolution, but Hoover succeeded in getting it approved. A German banker, Max May, now vice president of Guaranty Trust, became head of the foreign department of the Ruskom Bank in 1923, the first Soviet international bank. Who's Who states that Max May came to the U.S. 1883, naturalized 1888, vice president Guaranty Trust 1904-18, director and member of board Russian Commercial Bank 1922-25. J.P. Morgan and Guaranty Trust acted as the fiscal agents of the Soviet government in the U.S. The first shipments of Soviet gold, which was actually the Tsar's gold, were deposited in Guaranty Trust. In a typical move to disguise their operations, Otto Kahn and several officials of Guaranty Trust then founded an anti-communist group, United Americans, which circulated virulent anti-communist and anti-Jewish propaganda. Like most such organizations, it was designed to discredit and render impotent anyone opposed to communism who became involved in its work. On February 1, 1919, Edward L. Doheny, the oil tycoon, told C.W. Barron, founder of the Wall Street Journal, "President Eliot of Harvard is teaching Bolshevism. The worst Bolsheviks in the U.S. are not only college professors of whom President Wilson is one, but capitalists and the wives of capitalists. Frank C. Van Berlep is a Bolshevik. Socialism is the poison that destroys democracy. Socialism holds out. 74. The hope that a man can quit work and be better off. Bolshevism is the true fruit of socialism. The world headquarters of the Bolshevik movement was now at 120 Broadway on Wall Street. The Equitable Life building at 120 Broadway had been built by a corporation organized by General T. Coleman DuPont. During the early 1920s, 120 Broadway not only housed Equitable Life, but also the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, whose directors were enthusiastically supporting the Bolsheviks, the American International Corporation, which had been organized to aid the Soviet Union, Weinberg and Posner, which received a $3 million order for machinery from the Soviet Union in 1919, and whose vice president was Ludwig Martins, first Soviet ambassador to the U.S., John McGregor. Grant, whose operations were financed by Olof Asberg of Nya Banken, Stockholm, who had transmitted large sums furnished by the Warburgs for the Bolshevik Revolution. The London agent of Nya Banken was the British Bank of North Commerce, whose chairman was E.A.R.L.Cap.G.R.E.Y., a close associate of Cecil Rhodes. Grant had been blacklisted by the U.S. government for his support of Germany during World War I, and on the top floor of 120 Broadway was the Exclusive Bankers Club. These were the organizers of the world order. Their instrument of power was gold. The great Soviet encyclopedia noted, under socialist economic conditions, gold is also a universal equivalent, used as a measure of value and a scale of prices. The gold content of the Soviet ruble was established at 0.0987412 grams as per January 1, 1961. In the world socialist market, gold is used as the universal money. Many Americans are puzzled by the relentless devotion of the Rockefeller Foundation to financing communist organizations in many parts of the world. This dedication to communism can be traced back to a crucial moment in the Bolsheviks' march to power. In 1917, Mackenzie King had established a lifelong relationship with John D. Rockefeller, Jr., whom he met in June 1914. They had been born in the same year, 1874, and seemed to agree on everything. Soon, King was working closely with Frederick T. Gates and Ivy Lee to further the Rockefeller philanthropies, which seemed to view communism as 75. The ideal vehicle to bring about world brotherhood. King wrote to this friend Violet Markham, "John D. Rockefeller Jr., the truest follower of Christ, has one purpose, to serve his fellow man." King resolved that his one purpose was to serve Rockefeller. He testified for him at the trial investigating the Colorado Iron and Fuel Company massacre before the Walsh Committee. The Rockefellers later tried to have Walsh framed and expelled from the Senate, but failed due to the obstinacy of Burton J. Wheeler. J. Edgar Hoover played a crucial role in setting up the frame. The Rockefellers helped Mackenzie King obtain government contracts for the Canadian Army during World War I, which set King up for later blackmail, the Panama hold over the vassals. King sold hundreds of tons of rotten meat to be sent to the Canadian Army in Europe, boots of leather, which were mostly pasteboard and which disintegrated immediately in the water-soaked trenches, rifles that jammed when they were fired, and color-type life preservers, previously condemned, which broke the soldiers' necks when they jumped into the water. Right parenthesis. While Elian T. R. Otsky was in New York in 1917, he received word to return to Russia at once to help bring off the Bolshevik seizure of power. Fidlockefellers gave him $10,000 in cash for his journey, procured a special passport for him from President Woodrow Wilson, and sent Lincoln Steffens to safeguard him on the journey. When Trotsky's ship docked in Halifax, the Canadian Secret Service, warned that he was on board, arrested him on April 3, 1917 and interned him in Nova Scotia. The patriotic agents knew, that Trotsky W., as on his way to Russia to take Russia out of the war against Germany, which would free many German divisions to attack the Canadian troops on the Western Front. Premier Minister Lloyd George indignantly cabled demands from London that Trotsky be released, but the Secret Service ignored him. By means never explained, Mackenzie King then stepped into the brig and obtained Trotsky's freedom. Trotsky continued on his way to Russia, and became Lenin's chief deputy in the extermination of Russian citizens. He also organized the Red Army with the able help of Wall Street lawyer Thomas D. Fisher. The agents who had arrested Trotsky were dismissed from the service, their careers were ended. As a reward for his intervention, the Rockefellers appointed Mackenzie King head of the Rockefeller Foundation Department of Industrial Research at a salary of $30,000 a year. The average wage in the U.S. at that time was $500 a year. Frank P. Walsh testified before a U.S. commission that the Rockefeller Foundation was a cloak for the Rockefeller plan to lead organized labor into slavery. King also became a director of the Carnegie Corporation. A lady lawyer left him a large mansion in Ottawa, and in 1921 a group of well-wishers, led by Peter Larkin, refurbished and staffed it for him at a cost of $255,000. King then appointed Larkin High Commissioner of Canada in London. In 1940, the Canadian Parliament voted King, then Prime Minister of Canada, absolute and dictatorial powers for the duration. On King's 74th birthday in 1948, John D. Rockefeller Jr. gave him $100,000. The Rockefeller Foundation then put up $300,000 to pay for the writing of King's memoirs. In his final years, King, still on the take, was exposed as a principal in the $30 million Bohurnace Power Co. Point swindlering the building of this. Lawrence Seaway. King had accepted $700,000 from Bohurnace for the Liberal Party, and among other enticements had received a trip to Bermuda. The Rockefellers figured in many pro-Soviet deals during the 1920. Because of the struggle for power which developed between Stalin and Trotsky, the Rockefellers intervened in October 1926, and backed Stalin, ousting Trotsky. Years later, they would again intervene, when the Kremlin was racked by disagreements, David Rockefeller summarily fed Khrushchev. John D. Rockefeller instructed his press agent, Ivy Lee, in 1925 to promote communism in the U.S. and to spark public relations drive which culminated in 1933 with the U.S. government recognition of Soviet Russia. In 1927, Standard Oil of New Jersey built a refinery in Russia, after having been promised 50% of the Caucasus oil production. The Rockefeller firm, Vacuum Oil, signed an agreement with the Soviet Naphtha Syndicate to sell Russian oil in Europe, and made a $75 million loan to Russia. John. 76. 77. Moody had stated in 1911, the Standard Oil Company was really a bank of the most gigantic character, a bank within an industry. Lending vast sums of money to needy borrowers, just as other great banks were doing, the company was known as the Standard Oil Bank. As Rockefeller was no banker, this meant that the Standard Oil was being directed by professional bankers. The Standard Oil operation has always been directed by the most professional bankers in the world, the Rothschilds. Consequently, the Rothschilds, through their agents, Kuhn-Leib Company, have maintained close supervision of the Rockefeller fortune. Vertical bracket in 1935, Stalin expropriated many foreign investments in Russia, but the Standard Oil One properties were not ouched. The five-year plans, 1928-32, 1933-37, and 93842, were ill-financed by international banking houses. During the 1920s, the principal firms doing business with Russia were Vacuum Oil, International Harvester, Guarantee Trust and New York Life, all firms controlled by the Morgan Rockefeller interests. 1. Arthur Upham Pope's biography of Litvinov notes that in March, 192-1, a trade agreement was signed with Great Britain providing that gold sent in payment for machines bought by Russia would not be confiscated towards old debts or claims. This ensured that Tsarist gold sent to England would not be seized by his cousins, the British royal family. On July 7, 1922, Litvinov revealed that the Russian delegation at the Hague Conference was negotiating with an important group of financiers which included Otto H. Kahn of Kuhn-Leib Company. A week later, Kahn arrived at The Hague. He stated, "The conference with the Russians will bring useful results and will lead to a closer approach to unity of views and policies on the part of England, France and the US. In respect to the Russian situation, when Otto Kahn's wife visited Russia in 1936, she was treated like visiting royalty. In 1922, the Chase National Bank had established the American-Russian Chamber of Commerce to promote trade with and government recognition of Russia. Its chairman was Reeve Sly, a vice president of Chase. He was a director of many corporations including Howe Sound, Electric Boat, the Yale Corporation, chairman of Sunstrand and Underwood. He had served as director of the U.S. Fuel Administration from 1917 to 1919. His son, Reeve Sly Jr. was a captain in the O.S.S. under General Donovan in World War II. Both Chase and Equitable Trust led in granting credits to the Soviet Union during the 1920s. In 1934, Roosevelt established the Export-Import Bank (CAPFINANCE) increased trade with the Soviet Union. During World War II, Chase was Antorg's principal bank in handling the many billions of dollars of lend-lease transactions for Russia. Roosevelt went all out in supporting the Soviet's CAPJPRHAJPS because Al 30F, his personal assistants, Alger Hiss, Lachlan Curry and D.I. Larry Dexter W.H. Eit, were identified as Soviet agents. His mentor was Dean Acheson, formerly of J.P. Morgan Company, asked Secretary of State A.A. Burleigh Jr. Testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee August 30, 1948 that Acheson W. as the head of the pro-Russian grams up in the State Department. Acheson later became senior partner of Covington and Burling, obtaining the position for the firm, as Washington legal representative for nine communist governments. On April 29, 1943, the Board of Economic Warfare granted a special license to Chemeter Corporation of New York to fill an order from the Soviet Purchasing Commission for 200 pounds uranium oxide, 220 pounds uranium nitrate, and 25 pounds of uranium metal, commodities virtually unknown at that time, thus launching the Soviet atomic program. On January 29, 1944, Special Ambassador W. Averell Harriman in Moscow informed the State Department that we must turn over to the Russians the currency printing plates W. Hitch had been engraved for the U.S. Treasury by Forbes underscore Company of Boston. The State Department delayed action on this request for several weeks. On March 22, Harry Dexter White met with Gromyko at the Soviet embassy and assured him the plates would be delivered. Both Harriman and D.W.H. Eit made daily demands until the plates were turned over to the Soviet Union April 14, 1944. The Soviet Union then printed $300 yuan in currency which was redeemed by the American taxpayers. After the Cold War began, the financiers continued their efforts U is greater than aid the Soviets. In 1967, the New York Times announced that a new 79 consortium had been formed to promote trade with Russia, composed of Cyrus Eden's Tower Corporation, Rockefeller's International Basic Economy Corporation, and N.M. Rothschild and Sons of London. Eden had begun his career as a $2 a day factotum for John D. Rockefeller, who later financed his purchase of Canadian Gas and Electric Corporation. Eden stated that Rockefeller soon interested him in Russian affairs. In an interview with Mike Wallace, Eden claimed that under communism, the people of the Soviet Union were entirely contented. They were happy. I was amazed at their happiness and dedication to the system. Eden was one of the first defenders of the Stalin-Hitler Pact in 1939. The Rothschilds have rarely been identified with communist causes, preferring to remain in the background. Only one member in M. Victor Rothschild, who served an apprenticeship with J.P. Morgan Company, had become involved with the Apostles' Club at Cambridge, described by Michael Strait, as composed mostly of communists who were also homosexual. Its well-known members were Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean, Anthony Blunt, keeper of the Queen's pictures, and the double, or triple agent Kim Philby. During World War II Victor Rothschild, who was with M15, lent his London flat at No. 5 Bentinck Street to Burgess, while his mother, Mrs. Charles Rothschild, hired Burgess as her investment counselor. Blonde left the staff of the Warburg Institute to work with MI5. He introduced Victor Rothschild to his aunt, Theresa Mayer, who later became Lady Rothschild. Blunt has been recently described as having had an affectionate relationship with the Queen. The Rockefeller family is sometimes called the first family of the Soviet Union. When Nelson Rockefeller was nominated for vice president in 1967, Pravda indignantly denounced his critics, saying that charges against Rockefeller were designed only to discredit him, and that the accusations came from ultra-right-wing organizations. Senator Frank Church, attending the 1971 Dartmouth Conference at Kiev, was amazed to find that David Rockefeller was treated like we would treat royalty in this country. The Russian people appear to evince an adoration of Rockefeller that is puzzling. When David Rockefeller's plane lands in Russia, crowds line up to greet him at the airport and line the streets of Moscow as his limousine passes, hailing him with cries of Rockefeller. George Gilder remarked that no one knows how to revere, blandish and exalt a Rockefeller half as well as the Marxists. After World War II, Dean Acheson frantically lobbied for an additional $300 million loan to the Soviet Union. Ed Burling, who was Frederick A. Delano's brother-in-law, had founded the firm of Covington and Burling, of which Acheson was partner, with Donald Hiss, brother of Elger. When Acheson's lobbying failed to develop the Russian aid, the Council on Foreign Relations drafted the Marshall Plan as an alternative measure. Their publication, Foreign Affairs, then published the containment plan, as written by George Kennan. The policy of containment, which has been the official foreign policy of the U.S. toward the Soviet Union since 1947, guarantees not only Soviet Russia's borders, but the continued enslavement of the captive nations which she holds by military force. Henry Luce, who always provided a forum for the international propagandists, reprinted the entire text of the July 1, 1947 Foreign Affairs article in Life magazine, July 28. Its key sentence was the main element of any U.S. policy towards the Soviet Union must be the long-term, patient but firm and vigilant containment of Russian expansive tendencies. Luce's Time magazine dubbed Kennan America's senior policymaker. He later became a fellow of the Institute of Advanced Study of Princeton. Kennan was the nephew and namesake of the George Kennan who operated as a Marxist agent for Jacob Skifeff in Russia for many years before the Bolshevik Revolution, and was finally expelled by the Tsarist government. Kennan's pen name X was a favorite identification of socialist operatives. In 1902, the Socialist X Club had been founded in New York by John Dewey, whose socialist program has dominated American education during the 20th century. The other founders of the X Club were James T. Shotwell, founder of the League of Nations, United Nations, etc., Morris Hillquit, communist candidate for mayor of New York, Charles Edward Russell, and Rufus Weeks, vice president and managing director of New York Life, which was controlled by J.P. Morgan. 1881. When Nikolai Khrushchev, dictator of the Soviet Union, came to New York September 17, he was invited to dinner at W. Averell Harriman's home. 30 people attended, who controlled aggregate wealth of $40 billion. They included Russian-born David Sarnoff, head of RCA, Philip Mosley of the Council on Foreign Relations, Herbert H. Lemonoff, Lehman Burrows, Dean Ruskoff, the Rockefeller Foundation, George A. Woods, First Boston Corporation, Thomas K. Filiter of Cowdert Brothers, former Secretary of the Air Force, John K. Galbraith, economist, Frank Pace of General Dynamics. In September 1960, Khrushchev was entertained at Hyde Park at a dinner given in his honor by Eleanor Roosevelt. Present at this select gathering was Victor Hammer, who had fenced the Romanov jewels in the U.S. He sold many Faberge items to Lillian Pratt, wife of the General Motors tycoon. The collection is now in the Virginia Museum in Richmond, Virginia. In 1973, the U.S.-USSR Trade and Economic Council, consisting of leading U.S. heads of corporations, was formed to promote trade read gifts to the Soviet Union. In 1976, G.M. Miller of Textron was named head of the council. Shortly afterwards, he was appointed chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors by Carter. The Bolshevik Revolution, which was nurtured through its most trying days by three directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, William Boyce Thompson, George Foster Peabody, and William Woodward, continues to be supported by the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve System maintains close ties with the Gosbank, the Soviet central bank, which controls the Communist Party of the USSR. Gosbank employs 5,000 economists, and is known as a passive, rather than an active bank of issue, meaning that it follows orders from other sources, as does the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. The Gosbank Federal Reserve System cooperation in Soviet financial matters is handled through the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. In 1949, the present flood of euro dollars originated, as European deposits of communist dollar hoards in the Soviet Eurobank of Paris. 82. Banque commerciale pour Europe du Nord. The financiers then realized they created a new and even more untraceable source of paper money which had no backing. Anthony Sampson writes that the more cosmopolitan banks with foreign experts and directors, such as Warburg's, Montague's, Rothschild's and Kleinwort's, had also discovered a huge new source of profits in the market for eurodollars. These profits now amount to some $2 trillion, all of which are obligations of the American taxpayer. This Ponzi operation was made possible by the exclusive Central Bankers Club, the Bank for International Settlements, which had been established by Jammer Schacht, financier of the Nazi movement, Ethel Franke, guiding genius of Hoover's Belgian Relief Commission, and John Foster Dulles, heir to the title Most Dangerous Man in America. It was set up in May 1930 by the Hague Treaty to handle German reparations payments, which, of course, were never paid. BIS now controls one-tenth of the world's gold, which it rents out at a profit. Its assets have increased by an astronomical left square bracket 200% in FEDJ, as 20 years. U.S. shares of BIS are held by Citibank. /9th.cap/4%me. The Wall Street Journal noted editorially on March 10, 1986, hasn't it struck most Western policymakers as odd that the Soviet Union, with a total annual hard currency income of about $32 billion from all sources, including arms sales, can sustain a global empire? The journal noted that the Soviet Union has been a major player in the interbank market for many years, and that 6 Soviet-owned banks in the West have been the major beneficiaries of this global flow of interbank funds. The largest Soviet-owned banks in the West include Banque Commerciale pour Europe du Nord, or Eurobank in Paris, Moscow Narodny Bank of London, Ost-West Handelsbank in Frankfurt, and others in Luxembourg, Zurich and Vienna. Western deposits in Soviet-owned banks approximate $5 billion. What is going on here? Western nations deposit billions of dollars in Soviet banks. Where is the rivalry between communist and capitalist? The answer is that it is just where the fabled Soviet Empire has been, in Never Never Land. 83. American International Corporation Antinor Torre Sir Abraham the Scene's role in U.S.-Soviet dealings until World War II, when W.A. Harriman's presence in Moscow to direct Stalin's handling of the war usurped its duties. Standard & Poor's shows in 1982 an American International Group, an insurance holding company with $3.04 billion in assets, whose attorneys are Sullivan and Cromwell. It was formed from the Cornelius V. Starr Insurance Network, which was part of the CIA's Asiatic operations. Its directors include Harry Kearns, CHM in Eisenhower Nixon presidential campaign, now CHM in American Asian Bank, served as President Export-Import Bank 1969-73, William L. Hemphill, President United Guaranty, Director of Cone Mills. The Hemphill family has been allied with J.P. Morgan for many years, Douglas MacArthur II, Diplomat, John I. Howell, CHM in J. Henry Schroeder Bank, and Schroeder's Ltd. of London, Edwin A. Granville Menteen of England, who was chairman of American International from 1946-1979, now director of the Star Foundation, and J. Milburn Smith, director of Lloyd's of London. Prominent American businessmen and political leaders such as W. Averell Harriman do not bother to conceal their pro-Soviet activities. Russian Ambassador Dobrynin in casually referred to Henry Kissinger's double role, saying, "I am the laughing third man, sitting still. Kissinger is negotiating for us too." Brezhnev, dictator of Russia, was asked why the Soviet Union did not take a role in Middle East negotiations. He replied, "We don't need representation. Kissinger is our man in the Middle East." With this kind of influence, it seems odd that the communists do not precipitate a coup, and seize absolute power in the U.S., as they did in Russia in 1917. There are 200 million answers to this question, not 200 million Americans, but 200 million guns held privately by American citizens. A confidential Ford Foundation study showed that only 5 to 10% of Americans would actively resist a communist seizure of power. This was the good news. The bad news was that only 1% of our citizens, armed and opposing the takeover, would defeat it. Since 1948, Americans have asked this writer, when the communists will seize power in the U.S. The answer is that they will seize power, after they have confiscated the 200 million guns. Guns are forbidden in the Soviet Union. Only. 84. The highest officials are allowed to possess them. Criminals understand only one law, the law of force. The criminal syndicalists who seek to enslave the entire world cannot be defeated by humility or compassion, but only by the most determined and the harshest measures. To examine the American situation in perspective, there are only 500 men, primarily in the major foundations, who are actively engaged in transmitting international banker socialist orders to our government. Beneath them are 10,000 politicians, businessmen, media personalities, and academicians who, with the aid of religious operatives, implement the orders from London. This is a much smaller number than the members of the Communist Party of the USSR, which rules the Soviet Union. To protect these traitors, the U.S. government has imported 25 million aliens into the United States, which includes 5,000 intensively trained terrorists, and 100,000 hardened criminals. This force is intended to neutralize the opposition of the American people to communism. The government encourages crime, because it is the nationwide criminal force, not the police force, which keeps the population subdued. Americans must devote all their energies to defending themselves against the professional criminals, protecting their homes and families, leaving them no opportunity to organize against the criminal syndicalists of the world order. This clever plan of subsidizing the criminal element was the sole achievement of the Law Enforcement Administration, a foundation organization which originated at the University of Chicago. The federal government uses its armed police, the IRS, the FBI, the BF and the CIA solely to terrorize its American subjects into compliance with the program of the world order. Most American citizens have had to come to the painful realization that the FBI is not concerned with fighting communism, but only with battling American anti-communists. They now realize that the IRS functions as an armed group of terrorists, not to collect funds, of which the government has no need, but solely to extort money by force from American citizens, as part of the program of the world order. The intent is to render them impoverished and terrorized, so that they will be rendered 85. Impotent and unable to organize to resist the world order. It is the program of 1984. Even if they planned otherwise, the five masters of the world order have now created a situation which must lead to world war, world economic collapse, or both. The 30-year buildup of the Soviet Union as the next opponent in an ongoing world conflict was noted by Srali Blotnick in Forbes magazine, November 7, 1983, a wealthy New York lawyer whose portfolio contained substantial holdings of McDonnell Douglas, Raytheon and General Dynamics, commented, "It bothers me even to think what would happen if the Russians decided to take us up on our 5% a year solution to the arms race. Once we started dismantling our strategic weapons, the defense stocks will make the high-tech group look stable by comparison. The 60% loss I took on my Fortune computer system could be a hint of things to come." The world order has no religious, political or economic program, except world slavery. Only by subduing all potential opposition can the parasite guarantee his position of lodging on the host. The world order sets up countless groups to promote any type of idea, and then sets up other groups to fanatically oppose them, but the masters have no dedication to anything, except slavery. As R.E. McMaster wrote in The Reaper, the goal of international communism is not to destroy Western international debt capitalism. The goal of international communism is to enslave mankind at the behest of Western international debt capitalism. This is all you can ever know about the present world situation, and it is all you need to know. In 1985, In the initial printing of the world order, I posited a worst-case theory for the U.S. economy almost entirely dependent on the Soviet threat. A Russian revolution would mean the collapse of the U.S. economy. In 1992, we have seen the Soviet Empire collapse, and the U.S. economy is in shambles. Of course, the Bush League officials are frantically trying to convince Americans that there is no connection between the two events. In fact, the Soviet Empire is the empire that never was. There was a Russian Empire, under the S6 Romanovs, but after the biggest heist in history, when the richest man in the world, Tsar Nicholas, was robbed, and he and his family murdered by thugs who called themselves communists, a tremendous propaganda campaign, aided and abetted by the kept press of the world, has sought to convince us that communism exists, and that the Soviet Empire exists. I have detailed the financial and other support given to the Soviets by Americans, and most of all, the American taxpayer, on an ongoing basis, since 1917 to the present day. President Bush is now beating the Bushes for hundreds of billions of additional aid to Russia. This is nothing new. He is carrying on the tradition established by Herbert Boy, his grandfather and namesake, George Herbert Walker, when he became a director of American International Corporation, a Wall Street firm set up to finance the Bolshevik Revolution. What really happened in Russia in 1917? Through the furtive acts of British Secret Intelligence Service agents in Moscow, the Romanov government was overthrown, and a provincial government installed. In 1917, Russia joined the United States as a colony of the Bank of England. The Tsar's fortune was used, among other things, to purchase the stock of the Federal Reserve Banks for $144 million. Today, the rightful owners of that stock are the heirs of the Romanovs. George Orwell envisioned the world of 1984, in which two rival powers maintained perpetual hostility and martial law but never went to war against each other. 1984 continued in effect until one player, the United States, weakened and could no longer afford to subsidize its rival. What happened to the world communist threat was that the American taxpayer, looted and betrayed by the minions of the world order, could no longer afford to pay for communism in Russia. The charade came too close to collapse during the Burgess-McLean episode, when these British agents defected to Russia. They were followed by their handler, Kim Philby, who became a lieutenant general in the KGB. This episode almost exposed the behind-the-stage scenery, in which the British CIS, Mossad, the KGB and the CIA, inhabited a fairyland of their own, and in which harsh reality was never permitted to intrude. Why did these financiers indulge in this charade? For a very simple economic reason. Since 1917, the enormous wealth and potential productivity of the Russian people has been withheld from the world. A great rival has been handcuffed and condemned to prison. The problem which the conspirators of the world now face is how can they continue to hold Russia down? One reason that this farce ran so long on the Great White Way was the diligence of the CIA in promoting a false image of Russia. We now know that the Russian economy was never more than 1/10 of the annual figures furnished to our officials by the CIA. Financial writers such as Henry Rowan and Charles Wolfe, who argued that Soviet production was less than 1/3 of that of the United States, were shouted down by the CIA statisticians. When Russia showed signs of collapse, world order leaders were rushed to Moscow to shore up the ruins. President Bush himself made repeated trips to Russia for the Trilateral Commission to preserve the Soviet dictatorship. At Kiev, on August 1, 1991, Bush exhorted the Ukrainians to be good Soviet citizens, because the Soviet Union was reforming itself. 18 days later, it collapsed. So much for the wishes of the Trilateral Commission. George Bush's passion for Gorbachev cannot obscure the historical fact that the evil empire never existed from 1917 to 1990, which survived on gifts from Washington which were exacted from the American taxpayer. When the United States went into a recession, Soviet Russia collapsed. President Bush made so many trips to Russia to save the Soviet KGB regime that he faces serious problems in winning re-election in his own country. For many months, Bush dedicated himself to maintaining Gorbachev in power, as the KGB protege of the world order. While Bush sneered at Boris Yeltsin, and publicly snubbed him, he profusely praised Gorbachev, noting in his address to the nation, Dec. 26, 1991, I'd like to express my gratitude to Mikhail Gorbachev for years of sustained commitment to world peace and for his intellect, vision and courage. Bush had been quoted in USA Today on October 30, 1991, as reassuring Gorbachev, who daily faced ouster in Russia, that you're still the master. The Russian people ignored Bush's trilateral recommendation, and chose Yeltsin. 88. Yeltsin himself quickly came under siege of the aspiring agents of the world order. Aging and discredited Trotskyites crawled out of the woodwork, shrieking that they were still important figures. The Washington Post named some of his would-be American agents as Alan Weinstein, who describes himself as Yeltsin's man in Washington, a number of refugees from the Hoover Institution in Palo Alto, and a streetcar operator from Washington, D.C. named O. Roychuk. 8.